Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or a smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Radio Havana, Cuba, and NHK Japan. I need to limit using my voice, which went hoarse from using a medication. We will begin with France 24. First, 2 days of press reviews on the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. The first from last Friday and then Monday. Greenpeace says they have evidence of illegal deep-sea mining exploration by U.S. company TMC or the Metals Company. Then an interview with Ruzba Parsi, a professor in Sweden, about the U.S. and Iranian strategies in the ongoing war. France 24.
Litsa, papers across the world, of course, continuing to follow this new war in the Middle East. What have been the highlights? What got your attention?
Well, let's take a look at some front pages first, starting with Spanish daily El País here. That headlines with some numbers. It says that 2 out of 3 Spaniards oppose the war in Iran. However, 61% support sending a ship to Cyprus in response to the Iranian attacks there and as a commitment to defend the European Union. And then French paper La Croix here headlines with Trump's warrior transformation. The paper says that the attack on Iran shows a dramatic turnaround by the American president, who was once opposed to, quote, endless wars. And then the front page here of Lebanese newspaper L'Orient Le Jour shows the massive evacuations from Beirut's southern suburbs. The headline here is The headline reads, an entire population forced to flee. And here we see the traffic jams and people evacuating and children on the street.
What about the Israeli papers? How are they covering the conflict?
Well, a left-wing Haaretz here has an analysis that explain why Trump's fantasies for Iran go far beyond a regime change. It says that the joint U.S.-Israeli war is a bid to consolidate a new regional order in the Middle East. And Trump's vision for this order is not based on democracy, human rights, or international law, says the analysis. And the paper reminds that his central partners in the Gulf states are authoritarian monarchies where the ultra-rich employ migrants from the global south. And therefore, the new emerging order will be driven exactly by this, by economic interests, defense technologies, AI, crypto, real estate and finance, where the Gulf will be a haven for capital, not limited by, quote, the perils of democracy. And then let's take a look at a right-wing paper, The Times of Israel. It says that the Gulf states are living their worst nightmare and that for decades they have been trying to avoid an attack from Iran. And the article says that Iran hopes that inflicting enough pain on its neighbors will make Trump stop the war. But actually, it might end up backfiring, says this analysis. The Gulf states might end up cooperating even more closely with Israel, opening pathways to new unexpected alliances.
Antonia, the world basically woke up to 2 headlines this morning. What are they?
Well, Karis, on the one hand, you had headlines heralding an impending oil shock, The Guardian, on cost of living rise amid the war in Iran. L'Humanité here in France pointing to capitalism and fossil fuels bringing us to a breakdown point. Le Figaro, the world fears an oil shock. Meanwhile, on the other hand, Donald Trump's claim last night that the war was nearly over would, if true, make all of that moot. So other papers led with that focus. Corriere della Sera in Italy, Trump, the war practically finished. The Times, Iran has nothing left and the war is nearly over. And the Daily Telegraph, Trump, Iran war very complete, whatever very complete means. Regardless, one could be forgiven for being confused, waking up to these headlines. Is it peace on the horizon or a historic economic crisis?
Well, you've also been looking at analysis in the American press who have been following the money.
That's quite right. Well, the Washington Post has this piece on what it's cost so far, American coffers. $5.6 billion in munitions were used in just the first 2 days of strikes on Iran. This as the administration now prepares to send Congress an additional defense budget request in order to sustain the war. And now they're moving away from their more advanced, expensive weaponry they were using in the first days of the war towards cheaper weaponry, moving from millions per strike to tens or hundreds of thousands per strike. But it remains an extremely expensive business war. It's also a very lucrative one, as the Trump brothers have realised in this exclusive in the Wall Street Journal. The Trump sons back new drone company targeting Pentagon sales. This as Eric and Donald Trump Jr. back a new drone company targeting Pentagon sales called PowerUs. The company are working towards producing 10,000 drones per month, which would make them a US leader. And they're, of course, vying for their slice of the $1.1 billion that the Pentagon has said they aim to spend on US-made drones by next year.
All right, Antonia, you now have some news from the deep blue sea.
That's quite right. I'll start by showing you this communique from Greenpeace. So there's some bad news and some good news for the deep sea. As the International Seabed Authority meets this week, Greenpeace believe that there is serious evidence that subsidiaries of the US mining company TMC may be in breach of their obligations to the International Seabed Authority vis-a-vis the exploration of underground resources in the deep sea. Of course, this moving in the direction of the very controversial practice of deep sea mining.
We can cross to Rusbe Parsi, adjunct senior lecturer at Lund University in Sweden. A long war ahead?
I think the American assumption that the Iranians shooting off less missiles is an indication that they don't have them or don't have the capacity to shoot them off is wrong. I'm not saying that I know how many missiles they have, but I think it's also a bit, if you will, it's a big assumption and leap of imagination to claim that just because they're not shooting them means that they don't have them. I think they have a strategy, and it's a strategy that is not very unlike the Israeli-American one, which was to first destroy all anti-aircraft missile batteries and so on in order to have full control of Iranian skies. And I think what you see, what the Iranians have done, and it seems partly at least been successful, is to destroy the radar stations and other elements of the Israeli-American defense, which allows them to counter Iranian ballistic missiles. And once that is done, that means that it's easier for them to hit and exactly hit what they want to hit. And the question now is, do they have anything left to hit with? And I think I wouldn't make the assumptions that they don't just because they're not using them yet. They want a war that ends with Donald Trump understanding that there is a price to pay to wage war on Iran, so that whenever they sit down to negotiate, it will be much more serious than what Donald Trump has managed so far with his golfing buddy and his son-in-law. And that is their strategy. Whether they manage to pull it off is a different issue. I think the problem with the American war is that it's a war in desperate search for strategy. That is that they have had very different goals with very different levels of ambition and with very little planning in terms of how the military element comes together with the political end result that they're aspiring to. And so that's why we see these changing goals all the time. So yes, they might hit the Iranian coastline now because they're running from one crisis of their own making to the next. If they had known from the beginning what they wanted, it would have been easier for them to achieve it. And they would have known when to try and, in a sense, get the Iranians back to the negotiation table. But now the Iranians, I think, are going to play this game their own way. And yes, the U.S. can, of course, destroy even more infrastructure than it has done. But I'm not sure it's going to be enough to open the Strait of Hormuz, because as you showed in your earlier segment, the problem here is not that Iran is going to be able to hit a number of ships. It's the very threat and the fact that they now and then can lob something at a ship, which will make the insurance premiums go up and stay up and make the captains of the ship very reluctant to actually use the Strait of Hormuz. And that will have enough effect on the world economy to, again, raise the price for this American adventure.
Iranians still shocked by what happened back in January when thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, were slaughtered by the regime during nationwide protests. How has the mood shifted over the last 12 days from what you've seen?
I think, obviously, there are people in Iran who are so alienated by a government that so easily kills its own citizens that some of them were desperate enough to think that anything is better than this. And if the Israelis and the Americans can dislodge this government and this state, then it's worth the price. But I think they did not necessarily understand just how high that price would be, because they assumed, if you will, if we take the kind interpretation, they assumed that the Israelis and the Americans meant it when they said that they want this for the best of the population of Iran. And I think they've now seen that when you're attacking a country of the size of Iran and you don't have the political capital to actually put ground troops on the ground in Iran, you're going to do it from the air. And what you are doing is you're degrading societal institutions and destroying a state. That is the closest thing to a strategy that you end up with. And that obviously means that there is a high and huge price for the population to pay for this war. And it will not necessarily still guarantee success. So it's even that price will not guarantee that the Islamic Republic will fall. So you might end up in the worst of every world possible. So I think you're seeing some buyer's remorse from people who thought that this was going to be a surgical strike and it would somehow decapitate the government and everyone else would basically just flee and leave the streets open for the opposition to take over.
Ruzbe Parsi, so many thanks for joining us from Lund in Sweden.
Those press reviews and interview were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. Also, most podcast sites. On to Radio Havana, Cuba.
Radio Havana, Cuba is back on the airwaves. On International Women's Day, in an Amazonian town in Ecuador, indigenous tribes asked that nature be preserved. The U.S. and Ecuador announced plans to bomb alleged drug traffickers near the Colombian border. The U.S. killed another 6 alleged drug carriers on a boat in the Eastern Pacific Ocean. Trump met with the right-wing leaders of 12 Latin American countries, forming a military coalition called Shield of the Americas. Nearly 700,000 Lebanese have been forced to flee their homes from Israeli bombs. Israeli attacks in Gaza continue. In London, more than 50,000 protesters marched on the U.S. Embassy. Radio Havana, Cuba.
In an Amazonian town in Ecuador, in Pollo, members of various indigenous groups gathered to raise their voices about the degradation of the environment, the oil and gas expansion. We want to live in a healthy environment and in harmony with the forest, and we are asking for respect and that government policies for nature be put into place. The United States and Ecuador have announced that they will carry out joint operations to bomb supposed drug traffickers in northeast Ecuador near the Colombian border. The camp belonged to the Comandos de la Frontera, a Colombian group made up of former members of the FARC, the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia. The Pentagon in Washington, the War Department, says it has killed 6 men in an attack in what it called a drug smuggling vessel in the Eastern Pacific Ocean. Once again, the Pentagon provided absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the ship had been involved in ferrying drugs, though it posted a video on social media showing an attack on a civilian vessel. The latest attack brings the Pentagon's claimed death toll in their attacks on boats in the Caribbean and in the Pacific to at least 157.
The first secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Cuba and President of the Republic, Miguel Escanel Bermudez, stated on social media that the meeting convened by the United States in Florida with right-wing governments from the region commits these countries to accepting the lethal use of U.S. military force to resolve internal issues. The president described the meeting as a small reactionary and new colonial summit and pointed out that it constitutes an attack against the proclamation of Latin America and the Caribbean as a zone of peace approved in 2014 by the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. For his part, Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez also denounced on social media that the mini summit sought to impose a new version of domination through the Monroe Doctrine and its corollaries. The foreign minister considered it a clear and dangerous setback in the long and difficult independence process of the Latin American and Caribbean peoples. The Shield of the Americas summit, held this Saturday in Miami under the invitation of Donald Trump, brought together 12 right-wing Latin American leaders aligned with his administration as an instrument of selective hemispheric alignment.
In Lebanon, the United Nations warns that nearly 700,000 people, including 200,000 children, have been forced to flee their homes over the past week as Israel continues to rain bombs over Lebanon. Lebanese authorities say that nearly 500 people have been killed, with the death toll rising by about 100 each day. On Monday, Israeli airstrikes hit five branches of a financial institution run by Hezbollah in the southern suburbs of Beirut. And oil prices have fallen from a near-record high of roughly $120 a barrel after U.S. President Donald Trump suggested in an interview that the war in Iran could end very soon. And Israel is continuing to attack the Gaza Strip in violation of the U.S. brokered ceasefire agreement it agreed to last October. Earlier, Israeli tank shells hit a tent encampment housing displaced families in the western Nusrat area, killing at least three people, including two girls, while wounding 10 others, including children. Another strike in the western Gaza city killed three men, including a 31-year-old paramedic. This follows an Israeli drone attack on Saturday over the weekend that killed a father and his daughter in central Khan Yunis. Gaza's health ministry reports about 640 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli fire since the ceasefire was supposed to have taken effect 150 days ago, more than 1,500 violations by Israel of the so-called ceasefire. In Washington, the U.S. Capitol, the State Department has declared that the United States' war of aggression against Iran is an emergency, allowing the Trump administration to bypass congressional approval to sell more than 20,000 bombs to Israel. The weapons are valued at nearly $660 million. Meanwhile, Democratic House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries has declined to say whether he will block additional funding for the Pentagon's war against Iran, saying, "We'll wait and walk across that bridge when we get there." More than 50,000 protesters have marched on the U.S. Embassy in London, demanding an end to U.S.-Israeli strikes on Iran. The march was organized by a coalition of groups, including Hands Off Iran, the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Stop the War, the Muslim Association of Britain, and the Palestinian Forum in Britain, and the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Organizers said more than 50,000 demonstrators marched from Millbank to the U.S. Embassy on Saturday afternoon. This comes as the eighth day of the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, shortly after President Donald Trump said that the U.S. would hit very hard in the coming days. Now, as many as 10 days have passed, and the situation is only worsening. Protesters were heard chanting, "Stop the bombing now," and "Keir Starmer, be afraid, you will be seen in The Hague." The protesters in London. Your party MP, Sarah Sultana, spoke to the demonstration outside of the U.S. Embassy. She said, "Back then in 2003, we were told that long and other parties had weapons of mass destruction. We were told that war would bring about peace and democracy. We were told that the war would protect Iraqis and protect the world, but the truth is quite different. Sultana added, 23 years ago, when we marched against the Iraqi war, we were ignored. We will not be ignored now, because history has proven us right, and today we raise our voices for peace, for justice, for a world where the governments learn the lessons of the past. Hours before the march on Saturday, U.S. Air Force B-1 Lancer bombers landed at the Royal Air Force Fairford Base in southern England. War Secretary of the United States, Hegseth, said that the United States would use British bases to, in his words, dramatically increase the strikes on Iran. The British government has allowed the United States to use UK military bases for the purpose of targeting Iranian missile sites.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcasts. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at 6000. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Standard Time. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this show, my PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I am truly grateful for the donations. They're essential for the weekly production and website fees for this show. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. It is the 15th anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, and decommissioning will not be achieved until 2051. In Nepal, the youth have succeeded in electing a 35-year-old rapper, Balendra Shah, to be the new prime minister. Indonesia is joining many other countries in banning social media for children under 16. NHK Japan.
15 years since the accident at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, decommissioning work still has a long way to go. High radiation levels are hampering the already difficult task of retrieving fuel debris from the damaged reactors. But companies involved in the operation now face an additional complication. They don't have enough workers.
Ono Akira, head of decommissioning at plant operator Tokyo Electric Power Company, outlines the challenges ahead.
Our biggest problem at the moment is that we don't have much idea of where the debris actually is and what state it is in. So I think the major issue right now is to get a proper handle on this.
To remove fuel debris, workers first need to get a detailed view inside the reactor. This company in the nearby town of Naraha has developed remotely operated devices to perform such work. But they can't do it alone. Decommissioning work involves many different tasks spread over a long time frame. It is hard to plan ahead with staffing, meaning there aren't always enough workers available when needed.
Labor shortages could hold things up, and there's a risk that the decommissioning work will be delayed. I'm concerned about when the peak of the work is going to come.
NHK conducted a survey of companies involved in the decommissioning. All 12 of the firms that responded said they were having trouble securing sufficient personnel to do the work. 9 said an aging workforce and difficulties replacing them with younger staff were a key challenge. And 8 cited uncertainties about the scale and timeline of the project. Despite these challenges, plant operator TEPCO says it still plans to finish decommissioning the reactors by 2051.
15年経ちましたけども、やはり、まだまだ、
This has been a huge burden and source of concern for local residents, people in the prefecture, and society at large for the past 15 years. Our resolve to fulfill our responsibility to Fukushima hasn't changed. We will continue to carry out the decommissioning work safely and steadily, using various technologies from around the world and together with our partner firms.
Now for the latest on the general election in Nepal.
A relatively new party looks set for a landslide in Thursday's general election. The Rashtriya Swatantra Party is backing rapper-turned politician Balendra Shah, who's won the seat he contested. The RSP named Shah, a 35-year-old former mayor of Kathmandu, as its prime ministerial candidate. According to vote counting results as of Monday morning, the RSP has won over 120 of the 165 single-seat constituencies, or roughly 70%. It's the country's first parliamentary election since youth-led protests toppled the government in September. Shah and former Prime Minister K.P. Sharma Ali went head-to-head in the same constituency. Shah won decisively, picking up more than three times as many votes as Ali. During the campaign, the RSP touted anti-corruption and job creation policies that went down well with younger voters. The Election Commission expects the party to win an outright majority after pulling ahead of other major parties in the proportional representation vote as well. Hopes are high for the launch of a new administration that reflects the voices of young people. The Indonesian government says it's banning social media for children under 16. The country joins others around the world moving to limit children's access. Communication and Digital Affairs Minister Mutia Hafid outlined the regulation on Friday. She said the measure will prevent children from having accounts on what she called high-risk platforms.
Our children face increasingly real threats: exposure to pornography, cyberbullying, online fraud, and most importantly, addiction. The government is here so that parents no longer have to fight alone against the giant of algorithms.
The ministry defines targeted sites as those that enable interaction between users and allow them to upload content. Operators are required to deactivate accounts belonging to underage users. Mutia said the ban will apply to services such as YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, and X. The policy will be phased in from March 28th. Governments are increasingly tightening restrictions on children's social media use. Australia introduced a blanket ban late last year. Denmark and Malaysia are considering similar steps.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. NHK may also be easily found at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcast, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. Please consider subscribing. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. In April, the Shortwave Report will be celebrating having been on the air for 30 years without a break. Sorry about my lost voice. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.